TD News. I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a research-based master's degree in biological sciences covering diverse topics from ecology to molecular biology with a 90% placement rate. Become a leader in a science field that is shaping the future. Details at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we are commemorating Martin Luther King Day. We will first rebroadcast a conversation with the author of Hidden Figures, and you'll hear briefly from the daughter of one of those amazing women profiled in that book. In part two, a conversation about race in America with the late Dr. Manning Marable. Here's part one. I'm sure that many of you have seen the stirring film Hidden Figures, which tells the story of Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson, who were three of the black female mathematicians or human computers who worked at NASA in the 1950s and 60s. That film was based on a remarkable book by Margot Lee Shetterly, called Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. Shetterly's father was a research scientist at NASA and worked with many of the women who were profiled in his daughter's book. A little later, you're going to hear from the daughter of Katherine Johnson, Joylet Heilig, who had a hand in the creation of a wonderful children's book about Katherine Johnson and her exploits at NASA. But first, we're going to re-listen to that 2016 interview with Margot Lee Shetterly about her book, Hidden Figures. I'm excited to be talking with you about this remarkable story. I think I am like most Americans, knowing nothing about this story until the emergence of your book. You knew something of their story, of course, because you had the pleasure of knowing some of these women there in Hampton, Virginia. Tell us first where your personal connection began with them and how you came to know their story.
Right. Well, my personal connection really began with my family. My father is a retired research scientist. He worked his entire career at the NASA Langley Research Center. He started working there in 1966, so really, you know, during the height of the civil rights movement, during the height of the space race. And but here in Hampton, Virginia, there was a community of people of all backgrounds who were engineers, who were scientists, who were mathematicians. Many of them were women, and many of that group of women were African-American, among those the women that I write about in my book. So I was very fortunate to grow up in a place where I got to see African-Americans and women of all backgrounds working and succeeding in the science field and not think of that as something particularly unusual.
What really was the catalyst for these particular women becoming part of NASA was actually something which occurred over wide fronts during the Second World War, where so many men were called to the field of battle or called to be part of the military, even as scientists and in other roles, leaving gaping voids that in some cases had to be filled. And so this goes beyond the iconic figure of Rosie the Riveter, These are women stepping into voids that were essentially left in our aeronautics industry. Tell us about the transaction which allowed this to take place and what these women were doing at the time that this, in a sense, summons came from NASA.
Right. Well, women have always been interested in math. I think there's a sort of a perhaps a misperception about women and their mathematical abilities. But women who were good at math and who had studied math usually became math teachers. They put their degrees to use in the classroom. And then during World War II, just as you said, there was a tremendous demand for labor. There was a tremendous demand for aeronautical research. You know, planes had become this important agent of victory for the war. Like, this was changing the course of World War II. And so there in Hampton, they needed all hands on deck. They needed all of the mathematical computing power to do that research, to make the planes safer, make them fly faster, make them go longer distance without needing fuel. And what they needed were computers at a time when a computer was a person who was simply a job title, usually a woman in those days, who computed. So I think it's hard for us sometimes to remember just how transformative World War II was and how many things that we take for granted today happened during World War II. But one of them was that women were able to step into jobs that were previously allocated only to men and get a foot in the door and prove themselves. So this was certainly true of the entire group of women, and it had particular resonance for the African-American women who faced barriers not just because of their gender but also because of their race.
Right. And, of course, one thing that is maybe a bit uncommon about this particular story is that in so many cases, women who were given these exciting new opportunities during the Second World War found themselves shoved aside, not in every case, but in many, many cases, shoved aside once the war was over and life returned to some semblance of normalcy. But in this case, these women were doing great work at NASA and were allowed to continue that over the course of decades.
That is very true. And, you know, it's true that there were some cutbacks. You know, I look back at the records and the employee newsletters, and they talk about the cutbacks, and, you know, the war is over, and we're going to have to reduce our force. You know, but in the end of the day, even as World War II trailed off, there continued to be this demand for aviation. You know, planes, we take planes for granted. We go to the airport, we get on the plane, we don't even think about it. But, you know, planes really transformed in so many ways our modern life. And so, you know, as the continued demand for faster planes, for military planes, for supersonic aircraft, all of that continued through the late 40s, throughout the 50s, the Cold War, and then the space race. And all of those things require mathematical support. You know, you can think of all the things that we do with our computers today, all the analysis, all of the computing. We rely on them so heavily. Well, these women provided that kind of support to that highly analytical work that was being done there at Langley and at other NASA centers across the country.
As we mentioned, Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory is located in Hampton, Virginia. Virginia would have been a Jim Crow state with Jim Crow practices in place, Jim Crow laws in many cases in place. And one of the most poignant things about your book is the discussion of what that was like for these women to be working in a place like NASA, couched in a community where black and white were very much separated. And talk for a moment about that particular facet of this story and how important it was to tell that thoroughly.
Yeah, so the thing about it is they were, as African-American women, they lived in worked in a separate workroom. They had separate bathrooms. They had a separate cafeteria. You know, all of those things applied to them within the center, even though they had this new job that previously hadn't been open to them before. You know, it's a painful part of the history, you know, but it is a part of history. So we have to look at the thrilling parts along with the really painful and difficult parts. And they were truly patriotic, you know, despite that Jim Crow segregation. They never stopped working on behalf of the United States government, on the mission, for NASA, for, you know, getting American soldiers and pilots into planes that were safe, and eventually sending astronauts into space and landing them on the moon and bringing them home safely.
And one of the most moving aspects of this whole story is the fact that these women have not seemed to be all that interested in accolades. In fact, I'm curious to what extent they were receptive to the idea of their story being told in this way.
Well, you know, you ask them over and over again, what do you think about this sort of new light that's being shined on you and the work? And they, almost to a person, they say, you know what, I love my work, but at the end of the day, I was just doing my job.
Mm. The book, again, is Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. And the book is by Margot Lee Shetterly, soon to be a major motion picture. Margot Lee Shetterly, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book and joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you for having me on. It was a real pleasure.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Now we focus specifically on one of the remarkable women profiled in Margot Lee Shetterly's book, Hidden Figures, and in the film of the same name. Katherine Johnson worked at NASA for 35 years, calculating launch windows, flight trajectories, and emergency return paths. She did indispensable work on the space flights of Alan Shepard and John Glenn, just to name two, and her work actually extended all the way into the space shuttle missions and even into NASA's efforts to reach the planet Mars. NASA rewarded her for her great work by naming two of its facilities after her, and President Barack Obama in 2015 gave her the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Katherine Johnson was anxious to tell her story to young people and collaborated with two of her daughters, Joylette Heilick and Catherine Moore, in a book that has just been released by National Geographic called One Step Further, My Story of Math, the Moon, and a Mission. I was able to spend a couple of minutes speaking with Katherine Johnson's daughter, Joylette Heilick, who actually followed her mother's footsteps by working at NASA as a mathematician before bringing her skills and expertise to Lockheed Martin. So, Joylette Heilick, growing up, how much did you and your sisters understand about the amazing work that your mother was doing at NASA?
I don't think we did until way later, because she went to work every day. She was happy every day, and we knew that she was working on a space program, and so everybody in the community knew the ladies that were there, and, you know, we all did the work. The significance of it would have had to come from NASA. Otherwise, you know, they were all doing similar kind of work, so we weren't aware until I think my sister saw a news article once because Mom couldn't come home and talk about it. So It was that was how we sort of found out,
right,
or started this journey.
Right. And yet what leapt out at me, one of my favorite lines in the book is where one of you write, "We didn't know what they did, but we wanted to be like them." So on some level, you seem to understand that your mother was a special woman doing very special work.
Yeah, but they worked every day. They dressed, we didn't have a lot of money, so it was, they were dressed every day. They went to work. We did other things. You know, we hit church and community and activities. So we just stayed on the straight and narrow. If you did that, you stayed out of trouble, and you weren't in danger. Yeah.
One of the things that your mother says in this book, your mother, Katherine Johnson, is, "I never missed a day of work. I loved the math, but even more, I loved asking questions." Explain why asking questions was so important to your mother.
Well, she said the dumb questions are the ones that you don't ask. Because asking means, her theory was that you must learn something every day. And so if you wanted to learn about something else, it may mean read, but it also may mean ask a question. So don't just sit back and wait for it to happen. Go after it. Ask the question as to why or what. Blaine? She was just curious.
Right. And, of course, she wanted to not just compute the numbers, but she wanted to know why these numbers were being computed. And in her mind, that helped her do her work even better. Explain how you and your sisters collaborated with your mother, Katherine Johnson, in the creation of this book, One Step Further.
Well, I always say that Mom was a born teacher, and she loves children and always feels that the sooner you get them involved in something, something like math, for example, or music, if you do it early on, then you create their interest as their interest in the world begin to develop. And so it just gets them started. And so she liked doing things like she tutored and whatnot. So she thought that the book would be a good place for them to start or to use as a reference to, well, if she did it, I can do it, because Mom was no different from anybody else.
A last question.
And it's a positive book. Mm-hmm.
It very much is. A last question. What was your mother like as a mother?
She was like most disciplinarians. You were punished if you did something that you weren't supposed to do. You had rules and you followed them. We weren't into going against what she said. And she didn't steer us wrong. She didn't tell us things that were dangerous or whatever. So she participated, but she worked all our lives. So all of us always had other things to do, and we always were helping her or Dad do whatever we had to do to make the house run, like clean or cook or wash clothes, all of those things, including doing well in school. And she didn't accept anything less than that in school.
The book, again, is One Step Further, My Story of Math, the Moon, and a Mission, the story of Katherine Johnson, as told with her daughters, including Joylet Heilick. Joylet Heilick, thank you so much. Best wishes to you.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, I want to replay a portion of a conversation I was privileged to record back in 2004 with Dr. Manning Marable, who for many years was professor of history and political science at Columbia University and founding director of their Institute for Research in African American Studies, and the author of a number of books, including The Great Wells of Democracy, The Meaning of Race in American Life. Among other things, we talked about the fact that Dr. Marable's own great-grandfather was a slave.
All of us are connected with history. History is not just a set of facts which reveal past experience. It is also the prologue to the future, so that how we see ourselves as human actors in the drama of daily life is profoundly influenced by the events that have come before. So as my grandmother said to me once when I was a small child, that if you don't know where you've been, how can you know where you're going? That the past is prologue for all of us. So the fact that my great-grandfather was sold on an auction block in West Point, Georgia in 1854, by the man who was both his owner as well as his biological father, speaks volumes about the complicated relationship between the master and the slave, as well as the complicated history, heritage of racial oppression within the framework of American democracy. There are two stories that America likes to tell about itself. One story everybody knows. That's the story of we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal. The story about the founding fathers. Rarely is it mentioned, except obliquely, that of those 55 gentlemen who went to Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention, that 25 of them owned slaves. that George Washington, our first father of our country, owned 200 slaves, that Thomas Jefferson had children with Sally Hemings, the young woman who was his wife's half-sister and also his slave, who he never freed. So that complicated relationship goes to the very heart of what it means to be an American, and it goes back to American history. So these issues are issues that have never fully been resolved in this country. We have never had a fully honest conversation about the meaning of race in American life. And a discussion about reparations really is a discussion about the nature of American history, a shared history, a narrative which is underrepresented within the mainstream literatures of this country and is underrepresented within the media and within our cultural institutions. And until we're honest with ourselves about who we are as a people, then we will continue to have a racial divide in the country.
Let's talk for a moment about one really intriguing point you make in your book, The Great Wells of Democracy, and in looking at those proposals which began to be carried out in the wake of the Civil War and then were cut back so severely and never really fully implemented in any meaningful way. You say at one point that historians very rarely ponder the question of what if, because that is not the objective of your profession.
That's right.
Nonetheless, you sort of engage in it so ever so briefly, and it really is an intriguing thing to wonder.
What would
have happened if the proposals that would have given land and some wages and presumably some opportunities to the freed slaves of the South, if those promises had been carried out, how might America look differently
today? Profoundly different. And the issue was quite simple. In 1865, you had 4 million nearly entirely illiterate African Americans who had been enslaved from 1619 to 1865. And the two demands that African Americans who had been enslaved had above all other requests, all other demands, were for land and literacy or education. People knew that knowledge was power, and they had to be able to read and write and cipher. And they also knew they needed to own land. A number of Union generals, federal generals, took the view, an abolitionist in the North, took the view that blacks would, without land, would never be able to have the kind of leverage on public policy that they would need to ensure that they could preserve their freedom. And they began to push for some redistribution of the land. Thaddeus Stevens, a prominent Republican Pennsylvania congressman, called for 40 acres and a mule for every black family. Now, I've done the math. There were in the South in 1865 about 350 million arable acres of land available in the 11 original Confederate states. There were 1 million black families. They could have been given easily 40 million acres of land, which would have been roughly the size of the state of Georgia and a bit of South Carolina. It's a large piece of property. It wouldn't have all been in one state, but had that redistribution occurred, and you could have focused solely on a redistribution of plantation properties by the people who led the South into the war in the first place, the generals, the officer staff, and the politicians who headed the Confederacy, and not even touched the small white farmers, the yeoman farmers who lived in the Piedmont or who generally did not own plantations in the Delta regions or in the Black Belt, in the heart of the Deep South. If you had had a distribution of plantation properties and giving blacks the access to learning and education, as well as the means to protect their land, their property, then I think you would have had a radically different history in this country, and probably no need for a civil rights movement a century later. By the way, I should make one other point. This is a field that is now being called counterfactual history. And I saw a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education documenting that the Allies during World War II knew exactly where Auschwitz and Buchenwald and Treblinka and other these horrific evil institutions of murder, mass murder, that were carried out by the Nazis during World War II. Why didn't they bomb them? When historians and scholars have gone back and talked to people who survived the Nazi concentration camps, the survivors, to a person, have said that they wished that they had been bombed, because they would have certainly, all of the people taken to the camps were killed anyway, and had the Allies destroyed the camps, they would have saved conceivably hundreds of thousands, in fact, indeed, several million lives. So that counterfactual history is perhaps a door we need to actually explore, because there were openings in American history that were lost by choices, bad choices that this country has made.
So that is the study of the what if.
That's right. That's the study of the what if.
Another what if to pose to you. Had our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, not been assassinated by John Wilkes Booth, to be succeeded then by Andrew Johnson, who rolled back many of these proposed gestures to the freed slaves. What difference might that conceivably have made? Is it even possible for us to know?
Well, we do know what Johnson did do. I mean, Johnson issued the proclamation pardon of May 1865, which pardoned nearly all of the Confederates and restored their property rights and began the process of shutting down the justice for African Americans. You have a rejection of the 40 acres and the mule proposal. The Johnson administration turned down a proposal by the American Missionary Association to give homestead properties in the west of the Mississippi River to African-American families. So a whole series of events occurred because of the assassination of Lincoln.
Hmm. Talk for a moment also about how there is not just the rolling back of promises, but also the institution then of what came to be known as black codes.
Right. Well, in 1866, the war was over and the Confederate leadership returned to the South. And so the ex-Confederates initiated a series of legislative measures at the state level called black codes that severely restricted blacks' rights. So in a state like South Carolina, for example, there was a law that was passed that declared that blacks in that state had to have a court license in order to be employed as a shopkeeper or an artisan or even mechanics anywhere in the state. Some states, blacks were forbidden to testify in courts. They were forced to sign labor contracts with former slaveholders. So it was a continuation of slavery. Now, these black codes were waived after 1867, when the so-called radical Republicans seized control of Congress, when the Northern Republicans, who were sympathetic to blacks' interests, gained two-thirds majorities in the House and the Senate so that they could systematically override Johnson's vetoes, then you had the elimination temporarily of these black codes. But after 1877, the compromise of that year that was eerily similar in a way to the compromise that occurred in 2000, where you have a Republican who is named president, but who is not elected president through the popular vote, and that there is a debate in the Electoral College that involves primarily the electoral votes of the state of Florida. This is how history often repeats itself. Mm. This happened in 1876. So Rutherford B. Hayes, who lost the election, actually, to Samuel J. Tilden, the governor of New York, by 300,000 votes, Hayes nevertheless became president, very much the way Bush did. Hmm. And as soon as Hayes became president, you have a rolling back of blacks' rights, I would argue, pretty much the way we've seen this under President Bush as well.
I don't know if you saw recently on PBS a documentary called simply Reconstruction, which sought to examine this period of our history. I thought one of the interesting choices made by the producers of that program, whom I interviewed on this program, was to take a very honest look at that period, and very much through the eyes of the freed slaves, of course, who ended up losing so much. But it was also a program that dared to be, at least in some respects, if not sympathetic, at least sensitive to what a difficult period this was for whites in the South.
Right.
A very turbulent time for them. And one is left with the sense that much of this which occurred was not done at least solely out of sort of a hatred, but very much out of a sense of fear and utter bewilderment in the midst of that chaotic period. I wonder if you are comfortable with looking at this period in our history in that way.
Well, it depends. The chaos depends upon, I suppose, which side of the whip you're on. You have to keep in mind that the vast majority of whites in the South prior to 1860, prior to the Civil War, did not own slaves. Only one in four Southern whites owned slaves. The vast majority of slaveholders owned only three or four slaves on average. It was the rare Southern plantation owner who owned more than 20 slaves. And only about 10 or 11 plantation owners owned more than 1,000 slaves in the United States on the eve of the Civil War. So when we talk about a slave society, you're talking about a society where a tiny handful of the white leadership of that society, barely 1 or 2% of the total white male population, really pushed the rest of the society into a war that destroyed that society. So I'm entirely sympathetic to the vast majority of whites in the South regarding their own situation on the eve of the war, but I'm not very sympathetic to the fact that they fought for the so-called lost cause, and that the lost cause, the Confederate stars and bars, the Confederate battle flag, represents symbolically a defense of human slavery. There's no way around it. For the descendant of African Americans, it symbolizes what the Nazi flag symbolized. It represents a repudiation of my humanity as a human being, as a citizen of this country.
We're speaking with Dr. Manning Marable, and he is the author of many books, including The Great Wells of Democracy, The Meaning of Race in America, published by Basic Books. Professor Marable will be speaking at UW Parkside this Wednesday on the topic of slave reparations, the land, the mules, the money. Let's talk for a moment, Professor Marable, about the dialogue, which actually has occurred over many years, but only very recently increasing in intensity, and that is the idea of reparations given one way or another to the descendants of slaves. First of all, how would you characterize the call for slave reparations until recent years? Where would that call come from? Did it penetrate at all into our national consciousness?
Well, the demand or the discourse around reparations has been around for well over a century and a half. The as I indicated previously, in the 1860s, there was a vigorous discussion around it. In 1915, the U.S. Treasury Department was sued for $68 million in reparations based on the unpaid labor of slavery. And this case was dismissed summarily on the grounds of sovereign immunity, that is, the inability to sue the government without its consent. Now, all of this changed during the period of World War II and during its aftermath, because Jewish organizations and the Israeli government examined the records of corporations, financial institutions, institutions and governments to see if they profited directly from Holocaust crimes. And in the 1960s and 70s, up to today, they were quite successful in showing that there are ways around statutes of sovereign immunity or statutes of limitations. And parallel motions for reparations began to flourish. One of those occurred around the Japanese Americans during World War II. 120,000 Japanese Americans, most of whom were U.S. citizens, were forcibly removed from their homes, dispossessed, and placed in internment camps in this country. In 1943, the Supreme Court said they had a right to do that. Well, the reaction against the internment of the Japanese led Gerald Ford to issue Proclamation 4417 in 1976, in which the U.S. government declared that the Japanese internment constituted a national mistake. It was under President Reagan, about a decade later, who signed the Civil Liberties Act recognizing Japanese-American internment was wrong and inspired by racism. Each surviving internee received $20,000. An educational fund of $1.25 million was established for the children of those who had been interned. So these models of successful reparations helped to inspire a discourse of reparations around other people who had experienced historic disadvantage by the actions of a government, and that the governments themselves that carried this out recognized their moral as well as their legal responsibility for redress. And that is the issue. These are the kinds of claims that African Americans began to make more effectively in the 1990s.
It's interesting to read the story of certain incidents which seem to have advanced this cause in some respects. I want you to talk for a moment about the so-called Rosewood tragedy, which seems to have played a significant role in bringing this whole question to the table.
Well, there have been a series of tragedies which have occurred in African-American history that highlight the demand for reparations. Perhaps one of the most prominent occurred in the state of Florida in the early 1920s when a group of whites who believed mistakenly and erroneously that a white woman had been sexually assaulted by an African-American male went on a killing rampage and descended upon a small village, a small community called Rosewood, Florida. No one is exactly sure how many African Americans were murdered. Estimates range from 30 to 200. But nevertheless, what did occur is that over a period of 2 days, probably more than 100 blacks were killed. Their properties were subdivided and seized by white sheriffs, police officers, and local merchants without compensation. Hundreds of blacks who were survivors were pushed out of the community. And this issue of what occurred in Rosewood was swept under the table in the state of Florida for 60 years. And it was only when you had the focus of the national media in the 1980s on what had occurred there 60 years earlier, that you began to see some kind of state-led action to provide compensation to the descendants and to the victims that had occurred in that crime. By the 1990s, when the state legislature passed a bill of reparations calling for financial compensation to the victims of Rosewood, there were only by 1994-95 only four people left. However, the descendants of the children and grandchildren of the Rosewood victims became the beneficiaries of a college and university scholarship fund at Florida A&M University, which is a historically black college university in the state of Florida. So once again, we see states waiving sovereign immunity and redressing issues of the historical damage done that was supported and carried out by agents of the state. And this is an important point, I think, for your listeners to think about. That is, there's a difference between guilt and responsibility. White Americans who are alive today are not guilty of enslaving anybody, nor are, for the most part, people under the age of 50, guilty of carrying out segregation against black Americans. But they are responsible, not guilty, but responsible in the sense that they are citizens of this country. And then when our government carries out an action denying the civil or the human rights of its own citizens, then that government is morally and legally responsible to compensate the citizens from whom they have taken their life, their liberty, their happiness. And as citizens, you are responsible for paying taxes. As citizens, we are responsible for compensating other fellow citizens who lost in material ways to the illegal and immoral actions of our government. So, you know, this is not an issue where we're saying to white people, you should be guilty for doing, you know, for carrying out crimes that occurred a century ago. The advocates of reparations aren't saying that. What we're saying is that there can't be racial peace in this country until there is basic honesty about a divided racial past that continues to create tensions, that creates the absence of honesty within the framework of public discourse on how we got to the point where we're at.
We're speaking with Dr. Manning Marable, author of The Great Wells of Democracy. In the closing minutes, let's talk a bit about how you would foresee such slave reparations, in fact, being paid. Because I think there are some who might feel entirely sympathetic to the concept and yet might have some misgivings in terms of just how something like this could be accomplished in a way that would not further divide the races in this country. Give us some sense of how you would foresee such reparations implemented.
Well, the first point I think that must be made is that reparations is not fundamentally about the money. A rape victim does not seek a trial to obtain financial damages, primarily against a rapist. What she wants is the truth of the story to be told. And the same thing is true for the advocates of black reparations. The argument that we would make is that white Americans as a group continue to be direct beneficiaries of the legal apparatus of white supremacy, which is carried out by the full weight of America's political and legal and economic institutions, which construct and accumulate economic and social disadvantage for black Americans as a group. And so consequently, the living legacy of that disadvantage, which emanates from slavery, it emanates from Jim Crow segregation, is a problem that all Americans must address. And that's not really a question fundamentally about money. It's about the honesty of history. This country, this government, 3 years ago at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, the Bush administration refused to state that slavery was a crime against humanity. It refused to state that, despite the fact that virtually every other government on the planet stated that. Now, why would our government refuse to state that? Because it knows that a recognition of a crime by the state makes it vulnerable to being sued. And so consequently, we lie to the world and we lie to ourselves so to evade the obligation under international law to recognize the damage that slavery and the transatlantic slave trade has done to this country. There, the corpses of millions of African people were thrown to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean over a period of 400 years. It was the largest forced in, migration of slaves in human history. And yet we have to ask ourselves, why is there no testament, no statue, no memorial to the survivors of the transatlantic slave trade in the United States? This country was constructed largely from slave labor. The Capitol building on the Capitol Mall was constructed by slaves. The White House was constructed in part by slaves. The Washington Memorial on the Mall, the foundations of it, were built by slaves. Let's be honest about where the foundations of the country have come from. And since we're not, and when we cannot be honest about where the wealth of the country has come from, we can, you know, like I'm here in New York, you can go down to Wall Street. Wall Street, the wall on Wall Street was built by slaves. The first market on the stock market was a slave market where slaves arrived at the port of New York and were bartered and sold on Wall Street. And so we were the stock, the first stock on the stock exchange. An honest conversation about that and what is the material compensation that must be met, I think that that's really secondary.
Let me just ask, it's clearly secondary for you. Is it secondary in the mind of most? I mean, that's, I think, a fair question.
Well, I think that there are ways to address that. I mean, the reason I keep emphasizing it's secondary is because the way that critics from the right attack it is to make the spurious argument, who gets paid, who gets a check, et cetera, et cetera. First and foremost is recognizing the truth of the history. My approach to this is not unlike my friends and colleagues who are concerned about the Holocaust and the issue of honesty in history, as well as Native Americans who are concerned less about the land and more about being honest about the treaty violations of this government and of the United States. But secondarily, if we want to talk about compensation, I would simply say that there should be a national commission to address the historically constructed disadvantage that blacks suffer under that is a legacy of enslavement, of slavery and segregation. Black males, black people die 7 years earlier than whites. We have higher rates of hypertension. We have twice the rate of infant mortality than white people have. We have home mortgage ownership of homes 46% compared to 70% for whites. Why not a national commission that makes a commitment to achieve equality across the board? I don't mean material equality. I mean the elimination of these kinds of disparities of opportunity, that so that we make a commitment to reduce the life expectancy gap, reduce the education gap, reduce the home ownership gap, the business ownership gap that separates blacks and whites in the society. In other words, it becomes a national project to eliminate the structural disparity of structural racism that still plagues and festers at the heart of this country. So this is not just an issue that where we're talking about compensation for blacks at the expense of whites. We're talking about a national commitment to reconcile the races, to bring people together.
That was Dr. Manning Marable, for many years professor of history and political science at Columbia University and author of The Great Wells of Democracy, The Meaning of Race in American Life. Dr. Marable passed away in 2011. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Laura Levitt and an intriguing book called The Objects That Remain, looking at the importance of physical objects that are evidence of a trauma that we have experienced as an individual or collectively in something like the Holocaust. The Objects That Remain, a remarkable book.